Um das deutsche Paradoxon. Ja, was könnte das sein? Wir stellen alles ins Netz und finden es dann komisch, dass wir ausspioniert werden. So ungefähr ganz, ganz grob. Und ein Mann, der jetzt die nächsten 45 Minuten, vielleicht sogar 60 Minuten zum einen hier Rede und Antwort stehen wird, ist so ein Journalist durch und durch. Also ein Buch hat er geschrieben, What Would Google Do? Außerdem schreibt er übers Netz und über die Medien bei buzzmachine.com, hat überall eigentlich seine Meinung verfasst, ist TV-Kritiker und ja, jetzt kommt der gespielte Witz. Was ist das?
Jeff Jarvis hat vor 2 Tagen getwittert, dass er, und wenn er den Mut dazu hätte, sein iPad auf der Bühne Jimi Hendrixen würde. Und deswegen haben wir vorsichtshalber einen Feuerlöscher hingestellt.
Okay. Do you have your iPad with you? No. I'm sorry. Okay, also er hat jetzt genug Einführung erfahren. Ladies and Gentlemen, Jeff Jarvis. Bitteschön.
Dankeschön. Hallo Berlin. Zuerst muss ich sagen, dass es tut mir leid, aber mein Deutsch ist sehr schlimm. Seit Schule habe ich zu viel vergessen und gibt es zu viele Jahre. Also leider muss ich heute Englisch sprechen. So I hope that you'll tolerate that. So I want to talk today about what I call the German paradox, or as I was taught, das deutsche Paradoxon. I want to talk about privacy and publicness, and for that, to illustrate that, I will use penises. After all, it's Germany. So, I married into a German family, and mein Schwieger Opa, my wife's grandfather, used to say to us all the time, and say to me all the time, you shouldn't tell people that. No one needs to know that. Does that sound like your opa? Now, I think it's part of the German culture, and you will tell me in a few minutes where I'm wrong, but I think this link to privacy is somehow innate in the German culture, and I don't think it's just because of the Stasi and the Nazis. My German opa left in 1923, and it was in his soul as a German. And so I think that we find in this some really interesting ways to view the current discussion about privacy. And I think we talk about privacy too much, and I want to talk about the benefits of publicness. So, Germans and privacy. Street View has caused great controversy here. Have you all seen this video of Google Home View? Okay, so I won't bother showing it to you. For those of you, especially my American friends, who have not seen it, even if you don't speak German, you'll get the joke. Go look for the Google Home View video. So Street View has been very controversial here in Germany, so much so that the Google Street View car was sabotaged here. I don't think it was just a random crime. German privacy laws and privacy discussion is coming into play with both Google and Facebook. A German minister sent a letter to Facebook recently complaining about the privacy policies. Google is under constant fire. So I see this constant discussion about privacy here. But then I went to a sauna in Germany. And as an American, I was a bit surprised. This, for my American friends, is it mixed? Yes, of course it's mixed. It is men and women together, naked, in the sauna. What's the big deal, right? And I learned from that Germans care deeply about the privacy of everything except their private parts. And last night, as I was down on Rudi-Dutschke Strasse, I found a better illustration that I inserted this morning for that. By the way, I had this great contrast in media worlds in Germany yesterday. I went to visit Kai Diekmann, whom I know, and then I went afterwards to the Taz, where this is. He's quite proud of this. Kai is. So I'm not making fun of this in Germany. I'm quite the contrary, saying that I think there is a lesson to be learned for the rest of the world about this German attitude, and I want to try to dig into this. So what it makes us ask is, why is the private private? What should be private, right? So if you go into a German sauna, I've got a dick, you've got a dick, big deal, right? That's not private. To an American, that is shocking. I was at Davos, I'm sorry, I just did place dropping there, but I was at Davos and I went into a sauna there, and there were a bunch of sweaty Russians in there with me, all naked, and the door opened as I was standing there naked, getting out of the douche, and this woman opened the door, saw me, shrieked, and closed the door. I hope it wasn't just me that caused this. And I heard her husband, they were Americans, obviously, and the husband said, no, 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 honey, it's supposed to be like that. Yes, it is. And she came in wrapped in her towel so tightly she could not breathe, and looked up the whole time in the sauna. And I think that he had problems. But so each of our cultures has something different that we consider private. The Scandinavians have what we Americans think is this nutty attitude where they publish what everyone makes and what they pay in taxes. They are transparent to that effect. That amazes me. The Dutch are famous for leaving the curtains open on their windows, right? The funny thing about this is, though, I went to Google Street View to try to find an image for this slide. I couldn't find a single Dutch house that had the drapes open. Every one of them was closed. Maybe it's because of Google Street View. I don't know. We in America make crimes and criminals public, right? In the UK and Europe, that's often protected. Then, of course, there's Twitter and all of us sharing what we had for breakfast. We share and share and share, to the point that whenever I do sound checks now, like for this, they always ask you to say what you had for breakfast, and I now say that I refuse to, because you're not going to catch me as a Twitter user saying what I had for breakfast ever again. I won't do it. And then we're led to a question that I have every time I'm in Germany about Germans and their blogs. How many of you blog? Okay. Are you pretty much the entire population of bloggers in Germany? Entschuldigung? In Deutschland? Blocked in Deutschland? Oh, you're 50%, yes. Right. So every time I'm here, I ask Germans why blogging has not taken off here the way it has in other parts of the world, especially America. What are your theories? Why? Someone yell it out. Why is blogging not as huge here as it is in America? It is? It isn't. It is. Who agrees? Is blogging as big in Germany as it is in America? Tut mir leid, mein Freund. Your friends say you're wrong. I'm sorry. You German bloggers don't hold together. I hear all kinds of theories, right? One theory that I hear is the Germans don't like to share their opinions. Well, I watch your boring TV at night when you sit around with glasses of water yammering with your opinions. So that theory is bullshit. Germans like to share their opinions, right? Yeah. I hope you will soon against me. I heard a theory when I worked for the Volontera at Borda who said that, and try this one out, the Germans have never liberated themselves, they've only been liberated, thus they're not blogging. And I don't get that as a theory, but I also think it's wrong because you have the 68ers, right? And I've never heard a good reason why it hasn't really taken off here. So when I wrote my blog post about Das Deutsche Paradoxon, there was a commenter in there who gave me the best thing I've heard yet. Tillmann, that was the only name he left, said that the Germans lack a culture of sharing their knowledge and that you mistrust the fools for giving it away for free. Would you say that's fairly true of German culture or not? How many would say that's true of German culture? How many say no? Okay, the yeses win. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. But I'm trying to just dig into this idea that I see through your lens as best I can of privacy. And last night, after I saw Diekmann, I went to Tots, and there happened to be an event there on privacy in Germany, and I listened as best I could with my horrible German. And it's a constant discussion here. And so I want to dig into that. So let's talk first about privacy, because that's what everyone does. Privacy, privacy, privacy. Every time anything happens, we talk about privacy. Now, let me be very clear here at the beginning that I don't think privacy is the issue. I think that control is. We must have control of our information, our data. This involves a few things. But I saw a blog post just this morning where someone said, and I told this to a young reporter a few minutes ago who was too young to get this, so probably most of you won't get this either, that privacy controls are the new programming your VCR. How many of you here know what a VCR is? God, this is going to kill me, right? Okay, good. Fellow old farts, right? In the old days, my children, you got a VCR, you plugged it in, and it blinked 12 at you, and you never figured out how to program it. Right? The whole time, 10 years, it would sit there blinking 12 at you, and you never figured out how to program it. And then you got TiVo in the US. So the point about this is that privacy regulations, privacy controls are hard to use, so we don't use them, so the default that a service puts in there is what matters most. All that is true. There are issues with privacy, but I think the issue isn't privacy, it's control. We want control of our data. We want to be able to say what happens to our data, where it goes, who uses it, for what. Yes, and I agree with all that. We want to control our creations, our stuff. Has anyone here ever heard of George Carlin? Have you heard that? Let me see if I can play this, because this is, it probably won't work. I know how you feel. I share your pain. Tut mir auch leid. Okay. All right, this is a great routine by George Carlin, an American comedian who died recently, who talked about how all we need is a place for our stuff, and then we go from birth to death talking about our stuff. We want to control our stuff, but each one of these questions brings an opposite side. If you control your creation absolutely, well then, do you believe in DRM for others? Do you believe in it with Apple? So control for you gives control to others. Where does the line of control go with here? But I still think control is the issue. We want to control our identities. And note that I made that plural, because we all have multiple identities, even if it's under one name. We have our work identity, our blog identity, our school identity, our family identity, and then we may have other identities as well. And so we want to control our identity. So our data, our creations, our stuff, and our identities. That's what privacy to me is really about, is being able to control those things. Now, in the US, there's been a discussion lately about comments on news stories. That when we put out news stories into news sites, that the comments come in and they're all just awful and evil and nasty and horrible, right? Do you have the same problem here? Now, does that problem happen on your blogs? Do people get nasty? Yeah? It occurred to me recently, though, that the issue there isn't really identity. There are some who say that if we just required your real name, everyone would act in a civil manner, that identity would equal civility. Well, I don't think that's fully true, because I can name some people who are assholes. Right? Just because they have a name doesn't make them not an asshole. So that doesn't really take it away. And I can name people who need their meds, their medication, and really shouldn't be talking. Right? So that identity doesn't really fix it that way. And I think that in media, it's the wrong question. And this is a bit of a detour, pardon me. But the problem is that we in media allow the public to comment on what we have finished after we are done. What an insult that is to our public. Right? After we're completely done, we throw it over the brick wall. We say, now you're allowed to comment on it, but enough about you, what about us? And then we leave. And so people stand at that brick wall, and they don't hear us back because we've left. And they get mad, and they shout, and they spray paint, and they break windows. The issue is that we don't enable people to collaborate much earlier in the process. I'm talking with an American newspaper company, and we're going to try to publish an entire newspaper via blog software at every step along the way, and print becomes the end of that process. So I don't think identity is the key to civility, as people wish in comments. And it's just an illustration. Well, on the other hand then, does anonymity immediately mean you're going to have a lack of civility? Well, there's a reason to have anonymity in this world. There's a few reasons. One is China. One is Iran. One is whistleblowers anywhere in the world, whether for government or for companies. So anonymity has its place on the internet. Identity, to me, has more value than anonymity. I tell my commenters on my blog that if they don't have the balls to stand behind what they said as I do, then I'm going to respect their opinions and listen to them less. Because they're chicken shit. Right? But they have the opportunity to make that opinion known, and that's fine. So then does identity equal shame? Right, this is a great site, or a great Facebook group. Yeah, I was drunk in my Facebook picture. And there are lots of those pictures. So this idea that if we do something to be ashamed of, we'll never recover online. And that's part of the fear of this whole world with young people. I'm reminded of my dear sister. Luckily, she's not watching right now, nor are my parents. But when she was in college, she, horrors, stayed in a motel room with her boyfriend before they were to be married. They didn't get married. The stupid thing in that was telling my parents. I don't know why she did that to this day. And in the kerfuffle that followed, I remember my mother saying about the boyfriend, he'll never get a government job. Right. He was ruined for life, let alone, my father also had something to say about white at the wedding, but we leave that aside. Well, in fact, her boyfriend did get a government job, and my sister is now a Presbyterian minister in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, so everything turned out okay. So, you know, if we do one thing wrong or embarrassing in life, is that it? I don't know. Eric Schmidt said that by the age of 21, we should be able to give up our identity and start over. Obviously, he was joking. Other people have said that he should have picked an older age. Right, and that's one way to look at it. Michael Arrington on TechCrunch said that reputation is just dead. Forget about it. It's time to overlook our indiscretions. I have what I call the doctrine of mutually assured humiliation. You have your embarrassing pictures. I have my embarrassing pictures. So what? Or as we say in New Jersey, got a problem with that? Right? So we all have these moments of embarrassment. And why are they embarrassing? It's like asking, why is private private? Why is embarrassing embarrassing? It's because we set these strictures and rules in our society that says that. That's the problem. Now, you can say that these rules are there to make us behave better. Well, that's true, too. We all know what those rules are. But we have stupid, silly little rules that, oh, my God, she'll never get a government job. Silly. So, enough about privacy. All right, I wanted to acknowledge the issue of privacy, the issues of privacy. It's all complex. But what I really want to talk about today is the value of publicness. Because I think that in all this talk about privacy, we risk giving up incredible value in being public. So there it is. You've heard about it. Kai Diekmans, and now another one. I had prostate cancer, and I had it taken out in September. And I wrote about this on my blog in excruciating open detail. Now, if you're going to talk about privacy, there's nothing more private than your health data. And among that, there's nothing more private than your penis. But I wrote about it, even under the headline, The Penis Post, where I talked in some detail about my incontinence and impotence that comes from this operation. There, I've said it. Right? Why the hell would I do that? Well, I got incredible value from this. Incredible value. I got people who obviously came on and gave me support, well-wishers who gave me support, but I also got links to information, connections to information that was very, very valuable, that helped me make my decisions that you have to make when you have this operation because you have many choices. But more than anything else, I got people who shared with me what I was going to go through because they had gone through it. And they could only do that because I had announced that I had prostate cancer. There was a friend of mine who had the operation when he was 45. I had no idea he'd had it. It had been 10 years before. He sent me an email describing in great detail what I was going to go through in a way that no medical pamphlet from the doctor's office could or would ever do. That was incredibly valuable. And so when I blogged about this, and I said I was doing it so that people who searched Google for prostate cancer could find other people who'd had it, this friend came in and said, you know, since you've done that, I should do that too. And he repeated everything and more from his email to me in the post, in the comment, under his name. He talked about what it's like to have orgasms when you can't get hard and how you make love and all kinds of things. And I didn't make him do that. He chose to do that because he saw value for people in doing that. It was incredible. Another guy came in and left an equally detailed post, but under a pseudonym. And I understood why. But the next day he came back and said, if you guys are doing this under your name, so will I. Here's my name. A woman came in and said, I wish this had been here before when I got married late in life to my husband, and he had the diagnosis of prostate cancer before we got married, and he did not want to have the operation because he wanted to be a full husband to me. And I kept telling him, no, that doesn't matter most, but he's dead now. I had people who came in who said that they got their PSA tests because of this. All right, here's a test. Women in the audience, how many of you, by either mammograms or feeling examinations, have been tested in some way or another for breast cancer? That's all? Man, the German health system is not what I thought. How many men have been tested for prostate? Not many. Okay, get it done. You're over 45, get it done. I don't care what they say about stats and all that, just get it done. So, the value that came to me from talking about this extremely private thing. It's hard enough to talk about a penis, but it's worse to talk about it when it doesn't work. But I got value out of even that. So it made me think that we have to default to public. The problem in this discussion of privacy is we're defaulting now to private in a public medium of the internet. We're trying to lock down everything. When Flickr started, Katarina Fake said that they kind of accidentally came across defaulting to public. Every other photo service before that had defaulted to private because they assumed these are your photos, you don't want the world to see them. And they existed and they never grew. And Flickr, by chance, said, let's make it public. Well, incredible things happened then. Amazing things happened then. And you know what they are. People shared photos like crazy. The tagging structure of Flickr enabled people to share information about photos. If you look at the funny tag on Flickr, it's great. Flickr has this wonderful thing called interestingness, whereby every action we take on photos and by the social relationships we have, they find the photos that we think are interesting. That's our general knowledge, wisdom of the crowd, that they feed back to us the way Google does. By defaulting to public, by making it public, value came out of it. There is wisdom in the crowd. Now, the problem with me doing what I'm doing right now is that I am going against that. You know a hell of a lot more than I do, so what the fuck am I doing standing here and you're talking there? But we'll fix that in a few minutes. Every crowd is wise. Every crowd has wisdom, has knowledge. And how do you get that out? Now, the key insight that Google had was that. Yahoo saw the internet and thought like a librarian and said, let's catalog this whole thing. You think about it now, it's kind of silly and cute that they did that, and how impossible that is. Google came along and said, no, that won't scale. The only way to figure out the internet is to listen to the crowd's clicks and links. And Google then analyzes that and gives it back to us. And that is the value that Google has. There is wisdom in every crowd. I write in my book, What Will Google Do?, about the idea of a restaurateur opening up to her crowd in the room to listen to what people say for ideas. It's still her responsibility to cook my dinner. I don't want that done by the crowd, God knows. Nor do I want to do it because I cook as well as I speak German. But I do want to hear the smart ideas that are in the crowd, and we have to open up to do that. In fact, media organizations are so wrong that they don't. That's the problem they have with this whole idea of comments. They're not respecting the public to realize that it knows stuff. But the issue that comes up is, who owns that wisdom then? And that's a lot of what I was hearing, I think, last night, as best I could understand, at TOTS. Who owns this wisdom, and what can you do with it? Is it right to make money off the wisdom of the crowd? Well, if the wisdom of the crowd just sits there and we can't get at it, and you've brought it together and you've added value to it and you've analyzed it and you've fed it back to us in a usable form, I'd think, yeah, that's something we can discuss. The point is that the internet is not what we think it is. We don't even know what it is yet. We in media tend to look at the world in our own image, godlike. We think the internet is a medium, and it's not. Doc Searles, who was one of the authors, co-authors of the Clue Train Manifesto. Everybody read that? Who's read Clue Train? Yay, good crowd. It's 10th anniversary edition, out right now. I recommend it highly. You can read it for free as well at cluetrain.org. It is the seminal work of web culture, 10 years ago. Doc is the one who said to me, Jarvis, the internet is not a medium. In fact, if you try to call it a medium, you bring danger with that, because you bring things like government regulation here in Europe and in China, censorship. You bring this sense that media people have that they should and can control, centralize, and package the world for us. No, the internet, he says, is not a medium, it is a place. It is a place where we connect with each other, with information, with actions, with transactions. The internet, one way or the other, is a connection machine. Now, for that to work, you've got to say something. You've got to be public. When that works, it enables a lot of things. Now, you just had a great talk right before this, and there's a lot of debate about whether Iran was, in fact, a Twitter revolution or not. There's a lot of debate about the exigency of that. I'll leave that to Evgeny, not me. He's far better than I am at talking to those issues and raising those questions. But the point is, Clay Shirky says that we can now organize without organizations, and that is true. But again, the only way we can do that is if we are public. And in some cases, we do that at risk, but people choose to do it. It also connects us at an individual level. This is my chart of supposed friends from Facebook, kind of meaningless. But Facebook has done wonderful things. I often ask this question when I'm in groups of people older than you are, so I think the answer will be different. How many of you, in some cases the answer will be irrelevant for the reason I'm about to make clear, but how many of you have ever searched Google, Facebook, any tool online to find an old, lost high school or college girlfriend or boyfriend? Right. Usually when I ask that, three brave hands go up with old farts, right? And I compliment them for being the only honest one in the room. Of course everyone has, of course. Now, I went searching for my high school girlfriend. I couldn't find her. She had no Google shadow. She lived absolutely in private, no public aim at all. She, however, found me because I have a Google shadow the size of Utah and an ego to match. So we got together. My wife knows about it. It's okay. Believe me, nothing happened. But because of that, a few things happened, right? One was that we got to find out what happened to each other, a mystery that without Google and without the internet could never have been solved. We would have gone to our deaths never knowing. Second is I got to apologize to her for being an asshole at age 17 and stopping calling. By the way, I should update that's the phrasing from my generation, is that I didn't call. I guess the updated version of that would be I stopped SMSing, I unfriended you, I don't know, what is it? But my point is that in the current generation, which I ridiculously call Generation Google in my book, because what the hell, we got to name every generation, we in media, that won't happen, because people will be connected in some way through a web of people forever. And I think that means that we will treat each other better. That's the idea of the doctrine of mutually assured humiliation. We become more tolerant of each other's foibles. We stay connected. We know we can't run away from each other. We become more connected and more of a society. But I'm an optimist. But I think that's what happens. Mark Zuckerberg got into a lot of heat, and I heard him quoted 5 times at Tots last night about saying that privacy is dead. Tot. Well, here's what he really said, I think, which is that we are just sharing more and more information all the time. And I named this Zuck's Law, that we shared twice as much last year as we shared the year before. We'll share twice as much next year as we shared this year. We're just sharing more information. That's just reality, folks. That's the way we operate now. And we're not doing it because we're insane. We're doing it for a reason. We're doing it because we have value. It's not a wrong thing. We have to investigate what that value is. So, here's my big argument to you. Instead of just talking about privacy, 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 fine, agreed, control, agreed, move on. We now must defend the public. Because what is public is owned by the public, and we are the public. So when you cut down what is public, you steal from all of us. That's the doctrine I want to talk about today. There is a defense that I want to see of the public. So beware your precedents, my friends. When you go and stop Google Street View from taking a picture of a person in public, in front of a public building, you also potentially stop a journalist from doing that. Or you stop you from doing that. If you see a politician sneaking into that opium den and you want to take that picture, well, if you can stop Google Street View from taking that picture, why should you take that picture? You've created a control over what is in public. Eric Schmidt also got in trouble, like Zuckerberg, for saying that, well, if you don't want people to know about it, maybe you shouldn't do it. Well, in public, that's true. It's another matter if you do it at a private party, somebody takes a picture, puts it up. Yes, I agree with all that. But in public, that is the very definition of public. We, the public, own what's public. Mess with that at your peril. We want government to be transparent and public. We want companies to be transparent and public. Well, that has to come out of a principle of publicness. Let's go back to this question about Germans and their privacy. And I know I'm oversimplifying your views tremendously, but thank you. It's convenient for me for my argument. But this idea that the fear of violations of privacy comes out of the political history of Germany, I would also argue that one should be afraid of the ability of tyrants to use the cloak of privacy to kill publicness and hide their deeds. Publicness and transparency matters to all of us. It belongs to all of us. It is a value to society. And we're not talking about it, and we're not fighting about it, and that worries me. When you put up data for public, we all become journalists to the extent that we can find something and draw it to public attention. We may not do what journalists do. We may not report the story, but we can raise it. Mika Sifri, who is here and is going to speak, I think, tomorrow, is doing a lot of work on transparency in U.S. government. By putting data, the UK is putting up a lot of data. It's starting to happen here. The more data we have online from our government, the more we can all watch our government. Now, I think that gets a little negative, by the way. We're always trying to catch the bastards, and there are bastards to catch. Just like comments and media, we have to make government more collaborative, not all about negativity. But even so, it's our government, it's our money, it's our data, it's our actions, it's our society. The more public it is, the more we can all watch it and safeguard it. When you try to cut that down, beware. So transparency is the default we want from our public institutions. And if we do that, then I think it affects our private lives as well. That we see this benefit to publicness, and we see an ethic of publicness. It's the ethic I've learned in great measure on my blog, that there's a benefit to it, that I reveal a lot. If you go to the About page on my blog, it's obnoxious in its detail, just to make this point. But I reveal what stock I own, what consultancies I do, where I speak, what relationships I have, my come-and-go religion, who I vote for, all these things. Because I think it is beneficial to be transparent by default, public by default, versus the discussion we have on the internet now is to try to make everything private, almost by default. We give up value then. So the internet is a public place. So first I talk about the idea of the public and us owning the public. Well, the internet itself is the public. It is our new public. It is our new public place, our new public square. And I say that we have to defend that against those who will try to shut down parts of it. And we have to be smart enough not to do it ourselves, to ourselves. So we come to a world of walled versus open in all kinds of things. And I think that every time we look at the architecture of our new world, we have to ask this question of how it operates better. Now, we can argue about the iPad versus the WePad. By the way, I returned my iPad last week, so there was no need for this. I did a reboxing video. Now, Apple fanboys snarled about that and said it was just a publicity stunt because I wasn't sufficiently loyal to Apple. But notice, if you will, the brand of this. Notice, if you will, the brand of this. I remain an Apple fanboy, though they would drum me out of the core. And there's a discussion right now about what's better, Apple or Android. That's how I'm ridiculous. I carry two phones for that reason. We're not sure yet, right? The Apple apps are, in fact, better now. And the brand brings something and all this value. But there's something to this openness that matters. Whether the WePad here in Germany is going to be, you know, a big competitor to the iPad, I have no idea. But the fact that it has USB ports and a camera and Android, I think, is a benefit. But we'll see how this works out. By the way, I don't think the issue about the iPad and all that, the problem I had with the iPad was not anything really religious. It was that I couldn't see a use for it. Sorry to disappoint you before you all get it at the end of the month. I know I pissed off some of you. But I sat there on the couch watching a TV show saying, wow, this is cool. And then I looked up at my huge TV and I said, what am I doing this for? I sat there going through the web saying, oh, this is nice. But then I tried to leave a comment or send an email. It was a pain in the ass. Right? My religious problem with the iPad is primarily this, that I see a problem coming on the web, two things. One, when I complain about the iPad, people say, you don't get it, Jarvis. It's not about creation, it's about consumption. Well, that scares me that we move back to a world where we, the people formerly known as the audience, become an audience again. You are all creators. The act of consumption is an act of creation. What do you consume and how do we know about that? That's what Google did. Google turned our consumption of the web into the creation of our index back to the web. Public. So our acts are acts of creation, and I fear that this cuts it off. The other fear I have is that we move, I think we're moving on the web from a page-based web to something new. What I thought it was up until a few weeks ago was a stream web. Not we're going to get rid of the web, not get rid of the browser, but we're moving more and more to streams, to our Twitter feed, our RSS feeds, our this feed, our that feed. A young woman said to a researcher a year and a half ago, quoted in the New York Times, if the news is that important, it will find me. So a stream-based world. On the other hand, I now see an app-based world where content goes back in behind a wall. This is the reason publishers love it, because they think it gives them back the control that the web and links stole from them. Sorry, buddies, it's over. You no longer have control. That's the point. You no longer have control. That's what we're fighting about now. So open versus closed matters. Private versus public, opaque versus transparent, closed versus open, controlled versus free. It is a continuum. So when you talk just about privacy, you have an impact on what I think is this continuum of an open world. I had the hubris to pen a Bill of Rights for cyberspace. For those of you who haven't done it, I highly, highly recommend that when you're back on the internet, you Google John Perry Barlow's Declaration of Independence in Cyberspace, written in 1996. It is brilliantly done. And it says to governments and institutions, we didn't invite you here, you don't belong here, you don't govern us, stay out. And I love it. Then when Google left China, I was critical of Google for being in China, I applauded them leaving China, but it occurred to me that no one else is standing up besides Google to defend the free speech, civil and digital rights of the Chinese people, not the other companies that are helping build the firewall there, not the governments of the US, Germany, and Europe. No one. Well, as much as I'm a Google fanboy too, hell, I wrote a book about them, I don't think it's necessarily a good position that Google is our sole defender of rights on the internet. And Google doesn't want to be that. They want to be a company. And I thought about this and I said, well, why haven't these other companies come up with their chicken shit? They want the big market. They're greedy. But more than that, why haven't we stood up in defense of the speech of our brothers and sisters in countries where there's censorship? Why do not we stand up in defense of the internet and the publicness and openness of the internet? It's ours to lose, people. That's okay. That's okay. I just get carried away. It's all right. It's all right. You don't have to encourage me. It's a bad thing. Right? So I thought back to South Africa, and I do not for a moment mean to compare the tyranny, physical, economic, racial tyranny of apartheid to that of censoring YouTube videos. I'm not saying that. But when it came time for people to say to companies, you must leave South Africa, you must not support this regime anymore, how did that happen? It didn't happen because people just thought they should. It happened because there was the creation of what are called the Sullivan Principles, which said to companies, if you operate in South Africa, you must operate by these principles, or you must leave, and if you don't do either, then we will stop supporting you, and we will demand divestment. And what happened was those principles gave a rallying cry, a flag to stand behind, so that students around the world demonstrated to their universities to divest the investments in South Africa until this happened. Well, I think we need principles beyond Google's alone. So I proposed this Bill of Rights, which is really a lot about publicness. We have a right to connect and speak and assemble and act. Yes, we have a right to control our data and our identity, but we also must acknowledge that what's public is a public good and that the internet must be operated openly. Number 9 in there is a little call for net neutrality. Meine Freunde at Die Zeit, or Zeit Online, have translated it. A few other people have translated it. It's been translated into a few languages. Any of you who speak languages, I'll urge you to translate it. I don't mean to say for a second that it's the right Bill of Rights, but I do want to see us have this discussion. And so I think there's a continuum here in this discussion about publicness, publicness that has individual value, publicness that has value to a society as a whole. Publicness had value to me and my prostate cancer individually, but I also think that when we can share our aggregate data and knowledge, perhaps we can find cures for diseases. And if you don't share that knowledge, then you're being antisocial. You're ungenerously stealing knowledge from your fellow men you could help. Your knowledge has value. Your actions have value. When you do them in public, you share that value. It becomes a society value to do it. So, back to where I began. I think there's a lesson to be learned from Germans' attitudes toward their genitals. I think there's something to be learned also here, that we move past this to look at a free culture, and that that's where we ought to be considering this on the internet. In the company of nudists, no one's naked. We're all the same. We're all out there. We're all public. That's where we're going, is to a world of nudists. And I say that we can learn from Germany in your saunas. All of us. So, we're going to discuss this right now, but this afternoon, I will be next door at the day spa discussing this in a public sauna, naked. So, let's discuss. At this time, people always say, questions, bullshit to questions, argue with me, bring up your points, whatever. I'm going to come around and act like a damn fool. Come right up there. Okay, good. There's always that first moment when nobody has anything to say, and it's very embarrassing. Thank you, sir. Sorry, yeah, watch out. I'm tripping. Okay.
Hi, Jeff. Peter Sennhauser, Blogwerk. I have a problem with the American paradox. I live in the U.S., and I see there's a big difference in publicness as you feel it in the US and as we feel it here. Because the Americans are afraid of the government, while the Europeans are afraid of private companies. And in the US, the government is not allowed to collect any data about me, while here, private companies are not allowed to collect any data about me. The danger is maybe that regulation could keep the private companies in their corner. And in the US, you always try to keep the government in its corner. You writing about your prostate cancer in the US might not give you health insurance for the next 10 years. Here, we have a government that regulates that you can write about your prostate cancer and you're still gonna get health insurance. That's my first question. How about the paradox in the US?
Stay on there for 1 second, because that is interesting that if you try to go with the German question of saying that the reason we're so concerned about privacy is past governments.
Yeah.
But indeed, you're right. I think, have you blogged this yet? Please do so I can link to the blog.
Okay.
Because you said very well. I think it works both ways. I don't have the answer. I think it's very well said that we do have different attitudes about this. But I probably trust the market more than Europeans do, right? Why do I mistrust government more when we supposedly have such a good one for so long? I have no idea.
Okay.
Keep going.
And then there's the other question. I had an interesting discussion with a fellow blogger a couple of months ago who said, right now it might be a problem for you to be too public, to be too open, to tell embarrassing stories about yourself. 10 years from now, it might be a problem if there's nothing about you in the internet. So what time do you think this is going to happen?
I think it exists today. A friend of mine, Neil McIntosh, who was with the... don't worry, I'll run around. I'll come to you, you see. You don't have to come to me. I come to you.
I'm here.
Okay. Sorry, my theatrics got away from me. What was that? So I gave a speech recently to the American Society that runs old folks' homes, and I had a moment like this when I forgot, and someone yelled in the audience, "We have a place for you." What did you were just saying? Too public. I think it's just today. Neil McIntosh, who was an editor of The Guardian, is now at the Wall Street Journal Europe, said that he won't hire a journalist if they don't have a blog, because they're not trying it out. They're not being in public. I think we have to be public, is my view. And it gets to the point where you wonder, why are you hiding? Right? Aren't we thinking about that about companies today? Why are you hiding? They're thinking about us too. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm Jeremy Zimmerman, co-founder and spokesperson for La Quadrature du Net. I do care about civil liberties. I mostly agree with your analysis. And
but?
No. It's a very, very small...
That's okay. But's good.
I do strongly believe in privacy and the need for protecting it. What I think is that there is a boundary between the private sphere and the public sphere, and that first of all, people have to learn about that. Well, what is the difference between the two, and how and when you move the data from within the private sphere to within the public sphere? And my point here, how can we do this if some companies have an incentive to get more data in the public sphere? Won't they blur the line at some point? So can we do it with Google, Facebook, and so on, or is the only way to do it to use software and platforms that we control, that is free software and open platforms such as Identica or whatever other peer-to-peer search engine, so we control when the data go from private to public?
Got it. This is the question, well, two questions, media competence. Right, media literacy, we say, of English. There was discussion last night at TOTS at length. I couldn't understand everything said about it, but I could understand media competence. And I think we do have to educate young people today, especially, that the idea of media literacy is not just about consuming media, it is about creating media and the impact you have from that. Your responsibilities about that. It goes beyond being embarrassed. It goes to things like the ethic of the link. The link says to everyone, don't take my word for it. Here is the source. Here is my work. Go to that. Right. So. Media competence means many things. That's one of them. What's the best way to control? It's an open system. I think you're looking for, a lot of people are looking for some easy kind of law or system that will solve it all. No, it's going to be a mess. But at some point, Google knows that if they violate our trust, there is a perfectly good alternative for everything Google does. Facebook, a little bit different actually. Facebook is becoming much the network of our identity. And that maybe is a little more concerning. But at some point, too, if they mess it up too much, we will leave. And that's the power we have, the power of our feet. If we don't use that power, you can wish people use that power. If they say, hey, it doesn't bother me, then maybe you're not sharing their interests. Exactly. Who's? Who else? Yeah, okay. Am I driving the camera person crazy? Sorry. Yes.
Sure. Hi. I'm Dutch, by the way, so that's different.
Are your drapes open or closed?
They are open during the day and closed at night.
That's perfectly logical. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's very Dutch.
Yeah, it is. So I agree with both of the guys that just said something, and I just think right now, at least in the Netherlands, there's a problem where, you know, people like us, we respect that publicness, and we have like an intrinsic sort of respect because we grew up or we studied this stuff. But it seems like government and private companies kind of lack that respect, and you have horror stories like people get fired because they put stuff on Facebook or even just obscure things that employers find on Google and they get fired, or even people get arrested or stuff like that. So it seems like there's kind of a disrespect from the organizations that are top down organized, whereas all the internet stuff is bottom up.
Right.
And I just want to, he just said the education is really important, but for older people, like over 35, I think it's really hard to.
Hey,
I'm sorry.
Hey.
I'm sorry, I just had to say it. I mean, whoa. I didn't mean older people.
Man.
I just,
older
than Dutch me. I'm 23. Yes.
Okay, I got a good point. Yeah. That's up to us, I think, to some extent, that when we find out that someone got fired because they'd had one drunk picture up, we should expose that. We should say how stupid that is. But you're right, we're in a transition. The whole world's in a huge transition. We're moving from a digital, from an industrial economy to something that follows, and we don't know what it is yet. It's hitting media right now, but it's going to hit every other sector of society. It's going to hit advertising, retail, finance, education, government. What's happening to media is just a preview for the change in the rest of the world, and it's going to be messy, this change, very messy, but that's life. Next. We've got 5 minutes or less, so. Nurmena? Bitte?
I'm quite interested in you had some good arguments for the for doing things in public, and I'm interested in the other side. What do you think, which stuff should stay private? Is there room for privacy anymore?
Absolutely.
And why?
Right, absolutely. And I'm American of this attitude. I probably won't tell you exactly what I make, though I do share what I made from Google AdWords last year. I think it was about $3,000. I shouldn't have quit my day job. I think my rule is that I don't want to bring other people into my glass house. So I have to be careful about my wife and children. I don't want to violate their privacy, especially as children. I mean, it's bad enough that I embarrass them being their dad, you know. But I think it's a very individual choice. This idea of should be private is really you saying, well, I don't want to know that. Well, then don't look. So if someone wants to, I was hearing yesterday from somebody who was talking about the, I guess, the English garden in Munich, where you know, Americans drive by with people naked all over, and they say, that should be private. They shouldn't do that. That's my point. It's not up to everybody else to say what I should have as private. It's up to you what is private. Next. No quota, goddammit, but I get in trouble all the time. We have panels and things, but man, so speak up.
Okay, since you've been comparing Europe and the U.S., in the U.S. you have many more analogous walled communities than we have here. What do you think about the phenomenon of the walled community within the internet?
That's great. Yes, I think that we are more paradoxical in that because we are on the one hand, you look at Americans and say, would you shut up about yourself? You just talk about yourself all the time. I don't care about you that much. Yet we live in these private communities. And I think that that's what I want to avoid on the internet. And I think that's exactly what's happening. Next. Hi.
One little question. You have spoken very much about the mixture of the American mixture of public and private and the German mixture of public and private. But I have one little doubt. That is, will more transparency automatically generate more trust?
I'm an optimist, because the problem is this. I think that all we hear is pessimism. Not all we hear, but too often what we hear is pessimism. Oh my God, that could go wrong, that could go wrong. You're right, everything could go wrong. So what are you going to do? Spend all day in a shell? No, right? So we will not learn this new world and make this new world if we don't take risks and try shit. So we've got to try stuff. And things will go wrong. We'll make mistakes. That's the beauty of, I think, the beta view of technology on the internet, is that when you try things, when you open up your process, you become collaborative necessarily. When you don't, when you think, well, I have the best product in the world and I finish it, you're not collaborative. You haven't listened. Bitte.
Yeah, you spoke about internet censorship, and I think that's an issue which is growing up in every country, and they try to build fences around their country, and a German professor said that it's about the localization of internet to special countries. So we have the German internet, the French internet, and all that stuff. And you just said that you want to encourage us and maybe all other countries to fight against it. How?
Right. Best one of all. I'm not sure. Right? But again, if we don't start, if we just sit back and watch what happens, I think it's a very geek view. I'm on a podcast called This Week in Google, plug. And Gina Trapani is this wonderful developer who did Lifehacker, and Leo Laporte knows technology, and they've talked about this there. Because I'm the observer of this world, right? And the geek culture, I think, is we'll find a way around it, right? We'll always find a way around it, but that's not going to solve the problem either. Sometimes we have to look at it in the face, right? Google thought they'd find the way around it, they'd get along in China, okay, well, right? No, they had to stare it, they couldn't ignore it. So I think we have to look at whether we have the ability to create a movement here. You already have the movement, you are the movement, right? You're it. Well, what do you say about this stuff? The way we talk about this stuff, I hate it when people tell me I should write this or that on my blog. I hate that. So I'm not trying to tell you what to write. But I think we have to recognize our responsibility as the internet to protect what is the internet and to open up to a new world. Ethan Zuckerman at Harvard, a wonderful, brilliant guy who helped found Global Voices, is very happy that we have many languages on the internet now. People can speak their own tongue on the internet. But it risks that too. It risks closed worlds. The internet is a connection machine. The more we can connect with each other. I'll end with this. I got the hint. When I started blogging, I was amazed at the connections that could be made. And I remember starting kind of a world tour. Because Mein Deutsch ist so schlimm, I'm always trying to make it better. And as you can hear, I fail. One of the ways I've done that is trying to read newspapers and magazines, and then blogs came along, and I said, let me read these blogs. And I read German blogs, and I translated as best I could some interesting things, and I linked to them. I think the first one I did was to Der Schachwellenreiter. Yeah?
Last question.
Okay, I said, no. So I linked to you, right? And I think you linked back and said, who the hell is this guy linking to me? Isn't this strange, right? A connection was made. We've never met. Right? I've read you for years. And I haven't understood everything you've said, but I've read you for years. So that connection was made. That's the power of what this thing does, is we could never, ever in a million years have met before. I couldn't have heard the interesting things you said, but you said them in public, and because of that, connections are made. That's the moral of the story of the internet. Let's not lose that value. Vielen, vielen Dank.
Tiff Davis.
Heute Nachmittag, Day Spa.